Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So, this is a particular time for our monastery, our tradition, our connection with Thailand. I've seen on the news, you've heard it for many days now, this great being, the King of Thailand, who I know his life, I've read about his life, and I've known the good work he's done, and the tremendous, extraordinary being that he has been throughout his life, and always been very inspired by what Ajahn Amaro was describing, this young man who, at the age of 18, after having a normal Western, sort of kind of Western education, you know, playing jazz and painting and kind of quite an artist in many ways, you know, ended up being the King of Thailand. It's quite something. So for me, it's just a recognition of change. You know, it's a long period, 70 years is a long time. Yet here we are, changes is happening. And then this is one of the truths that the Buddha talks about, one of the three characteristics of that he describes in all phenomena is this nature of change, it's anicca, and it's dukkha. Obviously, how many people today are mourning and crying and missing this very inspiring figure in the country? I mean, I lived in Thailand myself for a few years, and I am aware of this incredible love that the Thai people have for their king. So it's very touching, even though I'm not Thai myself, but you know, I still remember the picture of the king with a little drop at the end of his nose that inspired so much the Thai people, because even though he was a king, he was still working physically hard in the heat and in the difficult areas, and still very dedicated to his people, even on the border of Thailand, like in the tribe, hill tribes area and so on, trying to help them to get a better living conditions and helping them and doing all kind of very creative and you know, very constructive work. So here, change is really striking big time this time, time in this life for the Thai people, but also for many people probably who have met him, known him, had connection with him. And it's always, for me, being a Buddhist nun, I find that you know, a Buddhist country is very important in my life. A Buddhist country matters a lot, because when you live in a Buddhist country, you feel that people understand why, as a monk or as a nun, you choose the path you choose. They may not understand always Sila Dharma, alms mendicant nun, but still, I have always received the most, the kindest, and the most generous response from my time in Thailand. So I'm very grateful myself to the Thai people. and certainly grateful at the very deep in my heart. I have a very hard time getting upset with Thai people. I can't think negatively about Thailand for some reason. I'm kind of conditioned just to feel good in Thailand. Now, this is just my personal perception and my personal experience. And one can argue there are many sites in Thailand, I mean, not so good or not so bright. But personally, I remember as soon as I arrive in Thailand, I feel happy. It must be the happiness of people around me. I'm sure that I share with others. And so I realize how much I cherish a place that where Buddhism is well established, is cultivated, is something that really has an enormous kind of influence on the whole psyche of a people in one country. Like Sri Lanka, even though I've never been to Sri Lanka, but I know many Sri Lankan people. And or Burma, again, I've never been to Burma, but I know that the Buddhism has influenced all this country for the great benefit. Of course, it doesn't mean it stops wars and it stops all kind of corruptions and all kind of terrible shadows in the country and terrible things going on. Mara is still at work big time, in those countries, in people's mind. It's not going to stop so easily. But at least it's counteracted by the force of Dhamma, the force of goodness, the force of brightness. So, one thing I've learned from being in Thailand myself is this incredible positive energy of people practicing Dhamma in Thailand. There's tremendous faith, there's tremendous confidence in the teaching, in the Buddha. Something that, and the not just the faith, but also the terrific devotion to the Buddha, to the Dhamma, to the Sangha. And I always felt we have so much to learn as Westerners, even though myself, I don't consider myself so intellectually educated, although I lived with a lot of educated people, my parents first, but I'm not a particularly intellectual person. I was, my training was as a dancer, more like an athlete, you could say. And I liked dance because when somebody suggested I was physically quite strong and able, when somebody suggested maybe I should teach gymnastic, I hated it because I wanted to leave something beautiful in my life, not just be a gymnast. I wanted to be something really that was expressing beauty. So dance seemed to be a good thing. And So you come to a point as a human being where it's very difficult to turn in any direction without finding something unsatisfactory. And it's, even when you search for something satisfactory, I think we learn quite quickly this kind of experience of disappointment. Again and again, we're looking for something with the best of intention, with a good heart, a kind intention, and so on. Still, we keep, for many years, we can keep bumping into the misery of feeling disappointed with life, feeling disappointed with people, with situation, with whatever we do. At some point, there's something that we feel boring and annoying and just totally basically not offering what we're looking for. We don't even know what we're looking for a lot of the time. And even though I spent several decades in monastery, I've learned that, many people come to the monastery thinking that they're going to find what they're looking for. At last, they find a monastery and they say, oh, this is a place. This is a people. And then, of course, by the time you leave 2 weeks with monastics, you realize, oops, maybe I should ask somebody else whether there is another situation that could make me happy, more happy than what they experience as a group of monastic living together, sharing a very difficult path. It's not easy. The path of practice is not at all easy. So I was quite, you know, in a way I was lucky to have a huge amount of energy and interest at the beginning. I didn't have a lot of, quite boisterous type, not at all a monastic type at all. I was really extrovert type, liking to talk and enjoy life, and you know, I was kind of more like a dancing type. And the idea of just being kind of quiet and disciplined and very restrained and so on was definitely going against the grain of my personality type. Well, that I come from the south of France, where lots of sun and lots of, you know, sort of external expression of one's self. So we look for a place where we can find, rest, in other words. And the Buddha calls it a refuge. You know, we the word refuge. Yeah. Sarana. And I think after a while, maybe we don't know what to name that what we are looking for. We don't know how to name it. Maybe we're looking for God. Maybe we're looking for some divine experience. Maybe we're looking for peace. Maybe we're looking for a good friend who maybe one day will make me happy. You know? But we don't have actually maybe a kind of, even there's no clarity about what we're looking for. And we're hoping to be clear one day. Once I meditate for a few years, then I'll be clear. We might be very clear that clarity doesn't come from the place you think clarity comes from. You know, we want to be clear on a rational, intellectual level very often. If something doesn't make sense, that's not clear. But actually, clarity doesn't come from that angle. And it's really refreshing when you hear in the teaching that when you're completely confused, completely unclear about things, completely unable to find your, you know, anything clear in your life, not knowing anything, still there is that dimension of clarity of knowing you're not clear. And that's the refuge of awareness that enable this kind of relationship to life, this free relationship to life. We can be completely confused, and we know you're confused, and that's clear. Now, you don't have to believe, we don't have to believe that, but eventually, certainly for me, eventually I knew it was true. Now, I wasn't a Buddhist when I started, and I never knew much about Buddhism. In fact, I was not interested in theory particularly. But for some reason, I always felt that seeing what is in front of me is clarity. What I can see now, here, now, was being clear. Now, that sounds very simple, doesn't it? What's in front of me, clear. You would think it's simple, wouldn't you? It's amazing how hard it is to see things as they are. I see people, and I'm sure I can include myself, we can practice for years and years and years, and yet we still don't see, we still don't know. And I was really struck with somewhere along the suttas, reading suttas, I came across just a simple words like the Buddha teach for those who see. And I added for those who know, but certainly for those who see, not for those who cannot see. And that, again, very simple words that express a profound truth. And this is the aim of your meditation practice, is to kind of built into yourself the ability to see clearly. And seeing clearly requires an enormous amount of inner freedom. Because if you're not free, you don't have this dimension of freedom internally, then you still see through the lens of, I want this, I want that. As long as there is an agenda, you're not free. You're caught up in an agenda. Okay? You're caught up. There's no freedom when you still want something. And I remember my father, when I was little, he used to talk, he had great admiration for what he called pure science. And I would say, what is pure science? It was, I think he explained to me that it's a kind of discovering something without having a particular aim. It's like a discovery that comes from just the search or the exploration of something, but you're not fixed on an object. Interesting, isn't it? Because our mind is so much conditioned to be fixed on an object, whether it's an object of meditation, an object of desire, an object of hatred, an object of aversion, whatever it is, it's conditioned to be fixed on objects. It's not really trained to actually see life with a freedom of not looking for something. You know, not searching. Just not searching freely, without the sense of I must find, I must get. My object should be like this. What I'm looking for should be like this, like that, etc., etc. This approach, you know, that actually limits our knowledge, because it's already tinted by, you know, colored by the desire to find something that we remember, you know, to find something that comes from the past, from memory, from conditioned experience, from conditioned perception, from conditioned thoughts. And that's when we get really frustrated, because we're still trying to find, you know, to be with things as they are, with the veil, the filter of my conditioned reality from the past, you know. So to see things as they are is what is enabled through the Buddhist meditation. I don't know any other meditation myself, but I know the path of practice, of a Buddhist path of practice. And this is quite amazing that even though it's there's an aspect of it which is extremely methodical, extremely defined, you know, it's extremely has a particular trajectory, you could say, a particular directions. The whole emphasis of practice is being with the way things are. And that seems simple, but being with the way things are is mean seeing things without the desire to have a particular experience, without a desire to find an object that you remember from a book you read 2 or 3 years ago, maybe, or an experience you had maybe last week, or trying to find something that actually is not here, is just a memory. So living through memory, you know, is neither good nor bad, but it's still not reality. So, you know, you can see the object, the memory as an object, you know, you can objectify memory, okay? But it's still in the way of seeing things as they are. That's why for a long, long time, even though we spend hours meditating, we spend hours reading the suttas, we spend hours, you know, getting so much knowledge on the intellectual level, yet we don't see things as they are. It's so close to us, you know. How many people, including myself, spend years kind of feeling quite angry about things, you know, but you don't think you're angry, you're just right. You know, they are wrong and you're right. Right? And so you don't see it. It takes quite a while to see something that's so close to our skin that it blinds us almost. We don't see it yet. You wonder why the Buddha set the patience as the ultimate quality for the path of practice. Is because it takes a lot of patience to actually see things as they are. Because we're constantly battling in our practice, in meditation, whether it's formal or informal, with the thing that things should be the way I think they should be. Things should be that way, not that way. You know, if you're a meditator, you should look peaceful, shouldn't you? How can you be meditating and not look peaceful? So in Thailand, you know that people are very... I think the Thai, what I see... quite, there's a bit of an attachment to appearance. You know, somebody is not peaceful. They must probably not meditating. They're lost. Well, I was glad to meet Ajahn Sumedho, you know, who actually taught me that you can meditate anytime, anywhere, with whatever, you know. I would never be here 30 years down the road if I had waiting to look the path of meditator. Because, you know, I used to run and walk and, you know, jump up and down and be quite sort of... expressive physically, and the idea of just kind of having my hands together on my belly and walking very mindfully and quietly with my hands slightly kind of humbled down was not the way I was particularly. I was like some of the younger nuns that comes and sort of terribly expressive, and you say, well, just calm down a bit, and they feel totally suppressed, you know. And I would have been like that. I was lucky to come as a nun in a community where there was no Mother Superior or senior nuns. I probably would never have survived a few years. Yeah, but we're lucky enough to be able to train ourselves. We had, you know, the people were there, the women with me. We had enough strength and determination and interest and love for what we were doing to actually train ourselves. And that's how we, you know, this community came about, without any idea to have a community. The last thing I wanted myself is a community around me. Four women was enough for the lifetime. Three women with me was enough. I had no idea. See? So things can happen without you thinking about it. Many things, most good things actually happen when me is not around. That's my experience. It's not that me is bad, but just if you cling to the me for too long, then you just cling to the past, you cling to fear, you cling to a lot of things that are not neither creative, nor free, nor spacious, nor ready to jump into the unknown. You know? That's one of the things that brought me to the Dhamma, is when I realized I would never want to live a life in a state of fear. And I realized life is a fearful experience. You know, it's very unsafe. You never know when you die. You never know when you're going to get sick. You never know if you're married or if you have children. You never know when something terrible is going to happen to either of your close friends or close relatives. It's a very uncertain world. So our life or practice, the path, you know, the Sila Samadhi Panya path, the Noble Eightfold Path, is there to build up slowly a foundation. Not enlightenment particularly, but it's foundation where you are able to little by little to get to know your refuge. This refuge. And that's, such a precious thing in our life. Without that refuge, after a while, you realize that without that refuge, we are completely lost. And refuge is not in the body, it's not, I don't know where it is, but it's certainly the place where my life returns. When I am mindful, when I am attentive, when mindfulness is present, then I am little by little, every time I cultivate mindfulness, I get to know little by little what the refuge, the sarana, is about. So this refuge can actually accommodate many things, anything. It doesn't have to be, it's not a place for special things, for when I am radiant and bright and this and that, or when I am miserable and down, whatever it is. It doesn't have to, it's a refuge for life in all its multifaceted sides. Whether you're angry, whether you're jealous, whether you're fabulously happy, whether you are, annoyed or worried about things. Isn't it amazing that this refuge can actually make us see things as they are? And to see things as they are, what you realize when you see things as they are, suddenly, when the actually objective of your camera, whatever your telescope is there, you see them, oh, they are an object. They're not me. They are something I can see. And I can begin to investigate. When I don't see it, I cannot do anything. If you don't see what you're working with, how can you understand what's happening? You can't. If you want to walk this path, of course, it's a path of understanding, it's a path of knowledge, it's a path of wisdom, where you're not just kind of fumbling around in the dark, but you get to know the nature of the mind, you get to know the qualities that are supportive of the enlightenment factors, you get to know the qualities that are leading you to a peaceful place, a peaceful refuge, the qualities that are leading you to crazy mind, hysterical, tendencies. It's a big learning. It's a profound learning of the life that you live with all the time. So the refuge is not the monastery, is not a place outside the monastery, is not your job, is not this or that. The refuge is quite independent of the external world. It doesn't depend whether your conditions of life are wonderful or not wonderful. The conditions in the situation in a monastery, the people you live around are great or not great, although it does help to have kind people around, I would agree. Kind of sensitive people that are actually not stepping on everybody's feet all the time. But when we start, you notice we are a bit like somebody stepping on everybody's feet. We're not terribly sensitive to others. Me first, it's like me. I need to go somewhere, right? You remember this expression, walking over your mom and your mother and your father, you want something, you get it. And let's face it, this society, like 20 years ago, was reinforcing that sense of, when you want something and you get it, you're really getting home. Even if you kill your mother and your father on the way, never mind, you're really getting home. I mean, psychologically, I'm not saying physically. Even if you made your mother and father terribly distressed, but you got what you wanted, or your friend, or your husband, or your wife, you got what you wanted. And that's a very different path when you start realizing that you are part of life in a much, much bigger picture than you think, than your little mind think. It's much bigger. One little action can affect many, many people in your life. And when we don't know that, we feel very lonely, we feel very isolated, we feel very, like we don't mean anything, we don't matter, we do not matter, we're not important in this life. We're not really worthy of this. You know, when actually, when you begin to see how, you know, much this life can influence so many other lives, any one of you in your life, you can have such a profound effect with very small things. Then it becomes really meaningful to, you know, sprinkling our house, and the house meaning our mind and body. Do a good spring cleaning there. Most of the past begin just with a spring cleaning. You know, we start learning how to speak at the right time, finding words that are, you know, described very beautifully in the Buddhist teaching, that brings harmony, that doesn't destroy people's spirit or confidence. Words that are gentle and kind, you know, compassionate. But that in itself, it's an enormous training, because most of us haven't been brought up with this kind of language. We've been brought up with a selfish language. Me first. You know, give this to me. Well, it's mine. I don't care. Give it to me. You know, it's like to want to do things, to want to get things on one's own, what you want, basically, on one's own agenda. And so, for some reason, we get lost, because if I don't do it on my own agenda, the way I want, then I feel I've lost my strength somewhere. This is what Vijja is about. You know, delusion is about. And we all have suffered, or probably will suffer, of that kind of perception. That if I don't do it my way, then something in me is not attended well. You know, I have to do it my way. And for me, as a nun in community, this is one of the things you learn. It's like is really not that important. In fact, not only is it not important, but the more dead it is, the better. the more it's gone, the better. Why? Because then you're free inside. You're actually free. You know, you're free to be the way life requires. You can respond to life, be with life, free. Whereas before, we are so, caught up with our fear, our anxiety, of not getting what we want, not being able to obtain the thing we like, you know, to have to endure things we don't like, you know, the description of the First Noble Truth in the Buddhist teaching. So we suffer, in other words, quite a lot, if we're not careful, if we don't understand. You know, you can be suffering, but if understanding begin to seep through our mind, then you find that there's much joy coming out of that. You know, it's like it's like coming out of your prison. You're liberating yourself already from the very beginning of your path. You're freeing yourself deeply already by just understanding, learning, and understanding, seeing. And when the consciousness is so attuned with this path of liberation, that when you have, when you feel miserable and you see the nature of this misery, for example, as just an example, you see the nature of this misery clearly, so a conscious seeing, mindful experience, then you see it truly as it is. Through that microscope, you see its nature is changing all the time. It's actually very often, it disappears when I'm mindful of it. Have you noticed that how your thought, you know, you want to see what you're thinking, suddenly you're aware of it as they're gone. You have to bring them back sometime. Ajahn Sumedho taught us how to bring them back. I hate her. Then we can spend years stuck in that thought, in those thoughts. I hate her. And then with no mindfulness, no seeing, no freedom inside, you just become the slave of your thinking. Then I hate her or him. And then Ajahn Sumedho taught us how to see the nature of that miserable sentence. And so as a meditator, we're just a microscope and we look at I, breathing, hate, breathing in and out. You can breathe in and out twice if you need that. Her. And then you see, this is just thoughts at that moment. But unfortunately, if we don't see them as they are, this is seeing them as they are, they kind of, they're just kind of festering unconsciously, in the unconscious. They fester. It's like, I hate her. You know, something in the inner, I hate her. You know, you see them, I hate her. You know. I mean, you can use anything. Where suddenly when you bring them into the field of awareness, of consciousness, then they have lost their power. They lose their power. They're just, you know, phenomena, that's all. Phenomena. And then you say, what is the mind, you know? I've lost my hatred for this person. And I know some of you are working with a lot of hatred towards people. I know. You've talked to me about it. You've talked to, you know, share stories over the years and so on. So start actually taking care of your mind. And taking care of your mind is allowing the mind to objectify clearly what goes on in it, so you're not just a slave of this whole kind of world of unconsciousness. The world of fear, the world of me first, the world of mind, this is mind, don't come here. The world of, you know, don't bother me. When you're in communities, a lot of people can be bothering you, as you've noticed, you know. And that's an intense training because we live together all the time, day and night, we're together all the time. And so we learn the very powerful way. It's not like maybe, I've been married myself for 10 years, so an intimate relationship or with someone you love and someone you like, you know, and then you can go on holiday and you can do this and that and you can have interesting time. You know, it's like we're all together, basically, doing this process of seeing Mara's work, you know. That takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength. And people don't always, we don't need to have reinforcement from people telling how wonderful doing this path, walking this path is. But for me, I can just know from my own experience, this is a very, it's not known. People can't know it until they do it themselves. The path of monasticism. It's hard, but who would walk this path of monasticism if there was not some reward? There is some rewards, of course, and the reward is that, you know, through noticing clearly cause and effect, clearly that's a wisdom path, cause, effect, cause, result, then freedom is in sight. You know, when I do this, I get this result. Okay, well, you do it 10 times, then you know it really clearly. You know, when I'm impatient with somebody, I might not see the first time the result. People get upset and angry with me, but I don't see the result yet. I just don't notice anything, you know. And then I do it again, and I see it. Okay, and little by little, we start learning. But at first, even though we may have been meditating for years, we still don't know. We still don't see. It takes much more than meditation to see and know. It takes the First Noble Truth. The Buddha didn't actually choose the First Noble Truth by chance. It takes suffering for us to feel the desire to change or to feel the urgency to actually transform our heart. It takes that much. It won't transform itself until you see the unsatisfactory nature of a habit or conditioning. So that takes a lot of courage to stay with just seeing something unsatisfactory long enough to actually come to the point where it goes. think Ajahn Ahimsaka was talking about this afternoon. When you just see something again and again, you have the patience to leave, to it comes back. And so, you know, normally you say, oh my God, here it comes again. Let's have a drink. You know, I'm fed up with that. You know, let's go to the movie. I'm really depressed. Well, let's go to the movie. And now, in this life here, as a monastic, you look at depression and you look at fear and you look at worry and you stick with it. You're actually really there examining it. And you can see its game, you can see its play, you can see all its lies, you know. And that's how you free the mind, little by little. But nothing do it as well as suffering, I'm afraid. Some people are maybe special. Maybe some people just get into, you know, all the jhanas and they free themselves. I met quite a few people who got the jhanas, you know. I haven't seen that myself. They're usually impatient, over-concentrated, and averse type. Not all of them, but I noticed that. I don't know whether that comes together with jhanas, but they're usually impatient and so intense. They have so much power, mind power in themselves. But maybe the wisdom is not yet around to actually balance out all the factors, you know, and more than anything, to be taught by life, you know, to let life teach us, because life is the most wonderful teacher in that way, you know. So you feel somebody's coming at you is angry and upset, you know, and you wish in your mind, why isn't she different? You know, I mean, she's practicing Buddhism. What's the problem? She's wrong. She should not be angry and upset if she was a really good Buddhist. Huh? But you don't see yourself, do you, at that moment? And if you replace the things, it's really funny. Then you start having fun with yourself. It's like, oh, she's angry. She should not be angry. She should not be angry. She should be nice and peaceful and compassionate. You know, the Buddha says compassionate. And she should not be like this, and she should not be like that. The mind thinks like that, doesn't it? We don't see the should and the criticism and the mind that wants its way. I want a compassionate Buddhist in front of me. I don't want, you know, a nasty, impatient, miserable-looking, depressed Buddhist. I just want the Buddhist, the perfect Buddhist in my head. I mean, ideally, a Buddha like this would be good, gold. Radiating gold and compassion, you know. So this is, there's many stories I can tell when you don't see yourself, you know. But I can tell you the part, one story when I suddenly, from not seeing, I saw. That might help. So, for example, I noticed, that's when I saw my anger, which is really important in this life, to see your anger clearly. Even though I was aware of my anger for many, many, many years, and I taught how to deal with anger for many, many, many years, and I read about anger for many, many, many years, okay? So I knew about anger, everything upside down, up, you know, across, up and down, and in, you know, right and left, and all the rest, you know? But one day, there was a monk who is not here anymore, and he, at Sarasini, I thought he was a very nice person, you know, very, very interesting, fun person, you know. I liked him, actually. He was a nice person. But every time he started talking or coming near, I felt really irritated, you know, irritated, I remember. And I remember thinking one day, I said, funny, when I speak to most people, I feel really fine and happy. Why do I feel the way I feel when I was this monk, this human being, let's say, forget about the monk, just human being. Why do I feel like this? Different. And then, as I was reflecting on my feeling, so I went away and I came back one day because we had to do quite a bit of talking together about the organization here and so on. And suddenly, I suddenly saw, oh, I am angry. But it was a very subtle form, perception of anger. Suddenly I realized that this whole body was tensing when I was with this person. I was becoming very tense and uptight. I never thought that this tension and uptightness was a form of anger, but it was. And so it's like not my anger, it's just anger in the body. You know, we're not born in, you know, enlightened, remember? So there was this tension and this kind of pressure is a form of anger in myself. And then when I saw this, then I began to see the difference, cause-effect. Okay, and I began to see tension, okay. And I could feel it started irritating me and started feeling kind of impatient with this person. And it was quite a big mouth, you know. He's like loud and speak, you know, very confidently. And, you know, that was fine. But sometimes it was a bit too much for me. And so when I saw this, I began to be more patient. I relaxed a bit more and I'd be more patient. So I realized I didn't have much patience for this person. So when I started having a bit of patience, I noticed more that it was really me having a problem rather than him. Or you can think of any other person, a woman or a man or friend, you know. Just suddenly that tension was kind of relaxing a bit. And through that, little by little, I saw the anger at another, from another angle, that this body and mind has greed and hatred and delusion well embedded in themselves. You know, they're really nicely kind of snoozing in there. And people can snood with them. If with no mindfulness, we kind of snooze with our skilesa altogether. You know, it's like kind of not only snoozing, but, you know, can't find a word in English. Snoring, that's right. Snoring with our kilesa, you know. And so sometimes that's why we need to wake up all the time. Wake up. It's hard. And one of the things that keep our, you know, kilesa snoozing together with us is actually a lot of sense of self, you know. Me, I'm not like that. I'm different, you know. I've been a Buddhist since I'm born. I know better than you. I know some of this, my friend, like that. I know. Yeah, but wait a minute, you know. Get a bit tested. Do you really know? You know, we don't know until we get a bit tested. And then we can know. Then we can really know whether you know or not know. Yeah. So for a long time, we think we know a lot of things, but actually we don't. We just think we know. This is called arrogance and conceit. And I've seen, I know it very well myself. I can talk about it, you know, for a long time. And this is it's another thing we don't see very well, this conceit. I know. I know better than you. You know, but again, it's not mine, it's not I. It's just there, like anger. It's just embedded somewhere, conceit, you know, and we take it for me, mine, you know. But it's not. It's just there. It's like a force. It's like a energy. It's like, and for a long, long time we suffer thinking because it's mine, it shouldn't be there. Because it's I, then I must be bad. You know, there's a lot of judgment comes up like that. So for us, it's really important to, you know, to remember that quality of building slowly a foundation. It looks like very little, but a foundation, you know, little by little. Even like when you come to the monastery regularly, those who live outside, you know, you suddenly, something shifts, you know, little by little. And it's not like you want to be shifting, you know, but it's just your awareness starts seeping through the energy. Even the energy of the temple, the energy of Amaravati is very powerful, mind, you know, a powerful energy of consciousness, you know. You can feel it. The mirror is very sort of clear, you know. That's why things get intensified when you come to the monastery here, because the mirror is clearer. How many times did I tell people, you know, I thought I was a nice, well-integrated social creatures in a society, you know. And then suddenly when you come to the monastery, you start wanting to cut everybody's head off, you know, because they just don't do the thing you like anymore. And you're not with the people you want to be with particularly. Or as I said a story so many times, you start having the perception, an intense perception of aversion, negativity, and anger for somebody who is cutting onions, not the French way, because I'm French myself, and just because they don't cut the way you were used to when you were a little girl, you saw your mummy doing it, or the person doing the cooking in the family doing it, then you start having a rage, for something so small. And that's when you begin to objectify a little bit who you think you are. Because we take ourselves so seriously that we just walk around like unhappy beings. But when you start objectifying yourself, then it's very humorous. You realize you're living with a life that you haven't asked for. You're living with a life you never thought you created. It's just got there here with you. Like you got landed with this whole world here, and you think it's mine. But actually, you just have to bear with it for a long, long time if you're in good health, short time. If you're not, maybe if you die early. But the beauty of this life is actually, this is our path. This is the path of practice. The path of practice is not somewhere in a book or somewhere. It's here. It's in the heart, right there. The path is right here. Don't look for it anywhere else. It's here. So free. It's free. It's with you all the time. And it's liberating. The Buddha was really kind, wasn't he? We might have to pay many dollars to get there, but there we are. Everybody can come for free here, can hear the Dhamma for free, we can go on retreat for free, we can train for free, we have food for free. Everything is free here. It's amazing, isn't it? And it's free because people are kind enough and generous enough to have a free heart to see what is needed to come and feed the monks and nuns. And we don't never dare saying that in the West, But when I was in Thailand, I had my upadak. A friend of mine was upadaking me sometime when we were going to different monastery. And I said, oh, thank you so much. I'm so grateful. And one day she said to me, why? I want you to be a nun. I want to support you. You would not be a nun if I can't support you. It's not personal anymore. It's like, if you want to make a cake, you have some ingredients, yeah? Chocolate cake, you don't take carrots in it. You put chocolates and butter and all that, yeah? And if you want a nun's monk, then you have to feed them every day. That's all. All you have to do is feed them and help them with the requisites. That's all. That's what it takes to have a Buddhist monk and a Buddhist nun. But in Thailand, it's completely normal. They don't think twice about it. They're very generous, very kind. So for us, it becomes very personal, if I'm a good nun, then I will be fed. Or if I'm a bad nun, it's true. You might not be fed if you're a bad nun or bad monk. But, it doesn't depend on that. People are so kind that even if they see you struggling or in troubles, they will much more, they have a lot of compassion. People have compassion for monks and nuns. So, no need to worry about it. So, it's getting late, and I really want to encourage you to get interested, deeply interested, in this quality of seeing, leading to understanding, leading to seeing dukkha, leading to seeing unsatisfactory, leading to the natural direction of liberation. Naturally, just go naturally. And that, I remember having that intuition before I even was a nun, that the less you touch life with the desire, I want, I don't want, the less your mind went into that way, the more somehow I get I didn't have a word, so the more things will work out well, everything will work out well, this intuition that the less I got caught up in what I want and what I don't want, I just had a sense, it will go very well when you don't know what to do, when you're skeptic about things, doubtful, or that. You know, just let your mind really just be aware of what's going on in you. And I didn't even have that kind of dimension particularly, but it was there. And then suddenly you feel you're guided by something much bigger than my fear, my desire, my anxiety. You're guided, you're led, you are helped, you are supported by something much bigger than us, you know. But it does take effort to create a foundation, just to have a foundation of practice, a foundation for our life. And the energy to actually to be interested in that. Because it's not the norm kind of thing. Our interests go immediately to sense, the sense door, sense object, sense pleasure. And then the other side, we kind of put a lot of energy into sense door, sense objects. I hate that, I don't want that. We do a lot of that, you know. It's like, I like, I want, I don't like, I don't want. The energy of bhava and vibhava is really churning in the mind all the time. You know, I don't want something. So we spend a lot of energy trying to get what we want all the time, and a lot of energy pushing away what we don't want. And that the Buddha's teaching is pointing that to the fact that this is the cause of suffering. If you don't want to suffer, stop doing that. And then see what happens. Because it's like a mystery. You don't know where you're going when you stop doing your habitual kind of shove. Off, you know, don't want, you know, you're kind of moving around all the time, wriggling. I had a lovely expression which I find, wriggling on life's seats, you know, it's like suddenly, constantly kind of pushing and pulling, you know, pushing. Now, when we do this, the practice is that I accept that as it is, I see this as it is, and I don't need to attach myself to it. Through, I don't want, it's bad, or I don't care, I'm going to have more of that, you know. We these two forces are so strong, you know. And then we add misery on top of misery by wanting not to see them as they are. They're just as impermanent, as insatisfactory, and as not self as everything else. And yet, you notice how much we are led by these things. So, it takes a lot of vigilance to be right there on the spot with these kind of forces. Otherwise, you never free the mind. And if you really want to be a good Buddhist, then the idea is to actually freeing the mind. You know, you go to the direction of freedom. You're not going to the direction of, I don't know, adding conceit upon conceit. You know, I'm a good Buddhist, you know, but what do you do to be a good Buddhist? You know, to be a good Buddhist, you have to actually start practicing. Otherwise, you're just an idea of a Buddhist, you know, an image of a Buddhist. That's different than actually seeing things as they are. And so I will stop there, and hopefully that some of what I said will help you to find more peace, you know, in the struggle of life.